They say the next big thing is here, that the revolution's near. But to me it seems quite clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is David Ruscio, who's Professor of Economics at Notre Dame University. His books include Economic Representations, Both Academic and Everyday Postmodern Moments in Modern Economics, and his latest, which will be out soon, Rethinking Planning, Development, and Globalization, Essays in Marxian Class Analysis. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Ruscio.
It's good to be back with you.
And David, I'm beginning to have a terrible sort of sinking feeling that there's an impending perfect storm of economic calamity gathering. When you have Wall Streeters like PIMCO's Bill Gross saying that the economy is at a tipping point at stall speed like an airplane, and Meredith Whitney saying we are heading for a double dip recession and municipal bond defaults are just beginning to cascade, and with the bond market slamming Spain and Italy, and then of course into this maelstrom steps the president, who co-signed his own suicide pact with the Republicans, who now say they got 98% of what they wanted from the debt deal. So it feels to me like we're in a kind of Smoot-Hawley moment, where instead of digging us out of an impending economic collapse, we're digging the hole deeper.
It's a good analogy. My analogy is a little bit different, although roughly the same period, and that's 1937-38. That's when FDR was persuaded to, quote, do the responsible thing and cut back on government expenditures. And, of course, the economy was sent into a second tailspin, never having recovered from the depths of the Depression that began in 1929. I think that's where we are right now. The economy is on the shakiest of foundations. As you say, the bond vigilantes are back now against Spain and Italy in Europe, and austerity policies are being imposed elsewhere, from England to Greece. Unemployment continues to be very high in the United States. There are now, 26 million people who either don't have a job or don't have a full-time job and would like a full-time job. And now the latest. So Obama gives away the store. The Tea Party is in full swing in Washington. And I guess, what is it? The Mad Hatter's in power? This is insane. Insane from just the most mainstream perspective. This is... Let me explain. One, there is no problem of a debt in the United States. The United States has no problem paying off its debt. And even if there were, and I disagree with that idea, but even if there were, even if somebody wants to argue that there's a problem of growing indebtedness of the United States, this is exactly the wrong time to attempt to do anything about it. So that's what we have. We have the Mad Hatter in control of policy in Washington.
Well, in effect, what the Tea Party is doing is telling the world, don't buy our tea bills, which is beyond being destructive and criminally negligent, I think. But instead of running against the Smoot-Hawley sort of know-nothings, the president's joining them in trashing the government and talking about dysfunctional government. And in a sense...
And I don't blame it all on the Tea Party. Excuse me for interrupting.
Go ahead.
I think... Yes, the Tea Party is important, and I think there are lots of things that we have to analyze there, including holding economic policy hostage in this case. And so the great compromiser steps in order to be, quote, responsible, just as I say FDR was in 1937. But we also can't forget that Obama, from the very beginning, also made lots of noise about the deficit. And once he did, because remember, that was the key idea behind health care reform, not to create universal health care, not to create a single payer or a single provider plan, but to rein in health care costs. And a lot of that had to do with the federal deficit, to appointing the deficit commission. Once Obama and his economic advisors did that, the game was lost. That was the setup for the Tea Party to walk in and hold economic policy hostage.
And David Ruscio, why did he do that? I spoke yesterday with Michael Lind, who's arguing, of course, that the Tea Party is actually a Southern party, and it's their brinkmanship is an example of the kind of hardball Southern politics. And he suggested that the president's actually a Rockefeller Democrat, that it's not that the president had poor strategy. It's the president actually got what he wanted. It's just that liberal and progressive Democrats don't get it.
Well, I agree. I think Obama and company did get what they wanted. I think they actually do believe that there's a problem of the deficit. I do think they believe there's a problem of the costs surrounding health care, and that's what corporations were concerned about, and that's why health care reform got put on the agenda in the United States. I think they got exactly. So it's a kind of absurd theater that we've been watching, in which it's portrayed to us as a determined, hostage-taking, what did Biden say, terrorist Tea Party, and the president being the responsible one, when in fact they agree on the bottom line. They agree that there is a problem. That's what I disagree with. And the only thing they disagree about is how one deals with it. That's the charade that's taking place right now.
Again, I'm speaking with Notre Dame Professor of Economics, David Ruscio. We happen to be speaking, David, on the 30th anniversary of Ronald Reagan shutting down the air traffic controllers, the PATCO union, which he busted. Interesting enough, in terms of the FAA and the airline world, here we have a situation where the $1 billion of revenue can't be collected because of the Republicans playing hardball in the Senate, where essentially what they're trying to do is reverse the rule to benefit Delta Airlines and help them in their union busting. So give us a perspective then on where we've come.
Well, to tie it back to this discussion, I mean, it is important that we're talking about this on this anniversary, because if we think about the point you began with, is there a chance of a double-dip recession? The fact is the recession never went away for the majority of people. There has, in fact, been a recovery, but only a recovery for the tiny minority. And one of the reasons that unemployment is so high, that wages have not budged, the people are working longer hours, is precisely because we're at the bottom of a 40-year cycle of trade unions in the United States. And that, for me, is part of the explanation for the Tea Party. We literally have no institutions left in which people can express their outrage at what's happened over the course of the past 3 years, that those responsible for the economic crisis are those who have most benefited, who have paid nothing, and the rest of us are the ones who are paying and getting no relief, and conditions are only going to get worse given the economic decisions being made right now.
But David Ruscio, if you have a situation where the citizen and the consumer has essentially no representation in Washington, which I think is a fair assessment, and that money rules Washington.
Right.
My sense is that the citizens simply can't whine, and particularly the Democrats who are now licking their wounds over this sense of betrayal in the last week. There's a simple solution to reversing the power of money over the power of votes, and that is to start voting. And, you know, I mean...
Yeah, but to start voting, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, in a democracy, that's how decisions get made. There are two problems there. One problem is a problem of organization. The other is a problem of leadership. If people don't hear alternative ideas, precisely the kinds of things that they hear on your program, if people don't find alternative institutions, they take a while to build up. So to give you a comparison, look at what's happening in Greece. Now, they didn't win, right? Austerity policies have still been imposed, but there was a lot of determined opposition within Greece, as there is in Spain and elsewhere in Europe, precisely because institutions exist. Trade unions exist. Student organizations exist. Alternative political parties exist. Precisely what is missing in the United States right now.
But I think
that's the next thing that's going to be on the agenda in the United States. I think that's the political solution.
Well, I was going to add to that, though, David. I think what the Europeans have is more political intelligence. By that, I mean that they vote for politicians who provide government services. They understand the simple transaction. You pay your taxes, you get your government services. And here, people are distracted, and the Tea Party, after all, is merely a distraction or one of many. They're distracted by all kinds of extraneous things and social issues. And there isn't, I refer to it as political intelligence, is perhaps a better way to put it. But how do you inculcate or introduce a new form of political intelligence where instead of saying, oh, we get taxed too much, which is not true, starting to sort of have the, you know, talk about, well, what do we get back for our taxes? And hey, wait a minute, what little we get back for our taxes, Social Security and Medicare, they're trying to take that away from us now.
Right, right. So part of our responsibility, you, me, others, is precisely to burst the myths. In other words, we have to step forward and say, here are the deals that are being struck. They're rotten deals for the majority of the population. A tiny minority benefits precisely on the issue of taxes, to take a concrete example. The United States is not an overtaxed nation. The United States has an overall tax rate that is much lower than any of the other countries, or any of the other industrialized countries.
It's about 30-something, isn't it, in tax to GDP?
Right. And so, and the average in the OECD, if you take it as taxes as a percentage of national income, in the OECD, it's about, 35%. The United States is much lower than that. It's below 30%. It's below what it was in the mid-1960s. So to listen to the rhetoric from economists, from politicians, and not just the Tea Party, the so-called mainstream, one would think that the United States is facing this mammoth tax burden. That's not the case. Now, it is interesting that as that tax burden has fallen, certain groups have been able to shift the tax burden from themselves to others. So right now we have the lowest effective corporate tax rate that we've had in 40 years. So corporate taxes on corporate profits are the lowest that they've been in 40 years. The same thing on wealthy individuals. They've been able to shift the tax burden onto the middle class. And guess who supports the Tea Party? The middle class and the upper middle class, who both aspire to be wealthy, right? So they aspire to have those low tax rates, but they're the ones whose incomes are remaining relatively constant, who are paying higher and higher taxes. Somebody has to step in and explain that. And they're not getting that from the mainstream thinkers in the United States. They're not getting that from mainstream politicians. That's what has to be reversed.
So, David Ruscio, then that explains why middle class and working Americans campaign essentially on behalf of billionaires to get tax breaks for billionaires and at the same time to give up their own health benefits, their own pension benefits, and their own Social Security.
Exactly. That was the basis of the property tax rebellion back in the 1970s, and that's the basis of this nonsense about, first of all, about being afraid of the deficit, and second of all, dealing with the deficit, not by raising additional revenues, but rather by cutting expenditures, thereby making the overall economic pattern in the United States worse, but especially that for the majority of the population. That's the insanity right now.
Well, given that I just began our conversation, David Ruscio, again, Notre Dame professor of economics, talking about Bill Gross at PIMCO, who's the big bond guru, Meredith Whitney, the municipal bond guru, mm-hmm. both saying, he's saying that we're at, like an airplane, we're at stalling speed and we could crash. And she's saying there is a double dip recession. The idea that this realization, which I think you can add to that too, Martin Feldstein at Harvard, they're starting to come out in the zeitgeist, literally a couple of days after this absurdity on Capitol Hill. Mm-hmm. My sense is, how quickly does the Pavlovian lesson come about, or buyer's remorse on the part of Americans who support both president and the Republicans? Because that's the tragedy here, that the president and the Republicans both own this catastrophe and this obscenity that they've just voted on.
So, but the problem is the following. The problem is not just to say that there might be a double dip recession. The problem is to analyze why that came about. Why did we have the crash of 2008, and why are we going to get a double dip recession now? And that's what the bond traders and Feldstein and others refuse to recognize, right? Because they refuse to say that a tiny minority made the decisions that created the crash of 2008, and a tiny minority who are benefiting from the economic policies right now. If you look at the stock market, not necessarily in the last week, but over the course of the last year and a half to 2 years, if you look at corporate profits, especially profits for banks, they're the ones who are walking away with the lion's share. Right? That's the analysis that has to be done, and very few people are doing that analysis. Right? That's why people are frustrated. So they're looking around. They're looking for intellectual leadership. They're looking for political leadership, and they're not finding it.
Well, you know, they're not going to find it in the mainstream press because, you know, in part, I think, due to this ridiculous binary notion that everything is equal and opposite and this fair and balance canard where you have the pro-argument and the con-argument and somehow you end up with this sort of meaningless mush. They were incapable, the mainstream press was incapable of saying that it was the Republicans who engineered this economic hostage crisis. Mm-hmm. I mean, they couldn't say it because that's not fair and balanced. That's how pathetic our discourse is, that you can't even call it as it is.
And they're not getting it from my colleagues in the universities. They're not getting it from the paid intellectuals of this society. So what they're getting are messages every single day in the form of white papers and in the form of press releases and so on from right-wing think tanks. They're the ones who are carrying the burden of opinion making in the United States, and they're the ones who are winning the battle.
Well, they're organized, you know.
Absolutely.
If you do any of the sort of connecting of the dots, invariably it's the Koch brothers that show up. You know, we just preceded you with talking about ALEC down in New Orleans having their big convention, you know, which is, you know, about the corporatization of politics. Of course, we know about the corporatization of the Supreme Court, which has basically opened the door to this extraordinary avalanche of money that's already infecting a completely mercenary polity. Well, just in closing, David Ruscio, can we come up with any kind of strategy here? I feel like a voice in the wilderness because I'm on a very, you know, small network that's, you know, largely stifling in its own footprint through its own weird and lunatic far left circular firing squad stuff. So I'm not encouraged being here in the middle of what goes for the American left. There's no encouragement. They're all sort of navel-gazing and talking about Ralph Nader or the Peace and Freedom Party, and that's clearly not going to get us out of this hole. What can you leave us with here?
What I can leave you with is two things. One is a responsibility. I am an academic, and it's no more encouraging to see my colleagues and their failure to articulate a way of thinking about the world in which people can begin to imagine an alternative, right? But that's clearly one of the things that needs to be done. It needs to be done patiently. A lot of people need to do it. It needs to be done over a long period of time. That's precisely the lesson you learn from the right. They have been doing it. The left has not been doing that important hard work. The other lesson is a lesson of history, which is that things change when you least expect it. You know, this is the example I give to my students is the 1960s. If you went to Berkeley in 1962, 1963, you would not have imagined anything changing. And within 2 years' period of time, you had a free speech movement and the beginning of what we now call the new left of the 1960s. The same is true of the French Revolution, the Russian Revolution, and so on and so forth. No one imagined them at the time, and yet we know when people are beaten down, as they are being right now, that new ideas, new forms of organization emerge. And so one of the things we have to do is keep alive the idea that something is seriously wrong right now. The only way it gets changed is by serious basic structural change and both, as I said before, political organizations and political leadership emerge in order to lead that battle.
But just to touch on the idea of how the right have organized, and we know the heritage and Cato and American Enterprise Institute, we also know that they're funded by big corporations like Coors and the Koch brothers.
Right.
There's no money on the left except, you know, one or two philanthropists. So
yeah, but the left has always done it without a whole lot of money. That's not the issue. What the left has is not a lot of corporate money. The left has a lot of people. Mm-hmm. That's always been our strength.
Right. Well, that's why I'm so I feel so distressed about Pacifica. It should be the network of the left that's inspiring the left and building a movement instead of peddling nonsense and conspiracy and self-marginalization and becoming the Tea Party of the left.
Well, exactly. And I mean, you know, there is a disease on the left. Listen, the left has no monopoly on craziness. We certainly have our fair share. But that gets shaken out. I mean, it's not serious stuff. And I actually don't worry about that a whole hell of a lot. We do have a responsibility. You have a responsibility. I do. Our friends do. And in all honesty, there are millions of people out there who are working in social services, who are working in schools, who are working in trade unions, who are ready to do something different. Right now, they don't have a way of expressing that.
Well, I appreciate the conversation, David Ruscio.
Thanks very much, and I hope we continue it.
Definitely. Again, I've been speaking with David Ruscio, a professor of economics at Notre Dame University. His books include Economic Representations, Both Academic and Everyday, Postmodern Moments in Modern Economics, and his latest out soon, Rethinking Planning, Development, and Globalization, Essays in Marxian Class Analysis. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be joined by Laiko Tongan, who's just back from a brand new country he witnessed the birth of. Stay tuned.
Brother, can you spare a dime? Once I built a tower up to the sun, brick and rivet and lime. Once I built a tower, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime?